previously on Getting the Mecha.
In this area, I think the Kyoto Saga arc is quite good as it focuses not only on Rin, but it focuses on the entire team. It does try to make links with things that will occur later in the series, of course that will be in manga content. But as also teased, there are still threats out there.
You are listening to the Getting the Mecha podcast, the anime and comic book podcast where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from OPs to episodes to arcs in my quest to make sense of all of it. In today's episode, we are discussing the festival arc of Aono Exorcist. If you haven't already, be sure to check out the previous episodes where I spoke about Aono Exorcist. So that was episode 1, A Demon Emerges, and episode 6. The Kyoto Impure King arc. Those are obviously preludes to this arc, which is the festival arc, but the main difference is this time we are talking about manga content. Hopefully you're aware that the Aono Exorcist anime has not been continued past the Kyoto Impure King arc as of yet, so that means we have to refer to the manga, and that's what I'll be doing in today's episode. If you do enjoy today's episode, or if you get value from it, leave a review, whether that's on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Give it a nice review and tell us how you feel about the show. So without further ado, here is the episode for this week. That is episode 16 of Getting the Mecha, the Festival Arc. The first thing to say, as always, is spoilers for the festival arc of Aono Exorcist. Probably some mentions of the larger scenes within this, and there is quite some big stuff that happens and goes down here, and I would hate for you to hear that and then ruin the entire series for you. So just keep that in mind and you have been warned. The festival arc, I think, is an interesting one, mostly because it stands between two quite big arcs. The Kyoto Impure King arc, which is one that feels a bit more disconnected to the main series, not to say that it's a bad part of the series, but it's definitely quite separate to the main series, or the first arcs of the show. And then it's sandwiched between that and the Illuminati arc. The Illuminati arc being a massive, massive arc in the show, or not particularly in the show, but in the series as a whole, as remember we're talking about the manga here. Definitely a big part of the series, which we will explore next time we speak about Aono Exorcist. But for now, again, let's focus on the festival arc. And with that, let's get to a plot summary. The Kyoto Impure King arc, or the Kyoto Saga, has concluded, which means that our young X-Wires have now returned to the True Cross Academy Cram School. But sadly, as battle shonens go, there is never really a time to rest or for peace, and that very much applies to the festival arc. Some weird occurrences have been going on in the school, and the reason for that is that the barrier coating the True Cross Academy Cram School has been breached. The reason for that, for the moment, is unknown, and as a result, our young X-Wires are tasked with defeating these quote-unquote occurrences, which are none other than demons. These demons must be exorcised, and there are multiple demons across the school which they methodically have to take down. However, the thing is, nothing happens by accident, and that is something that will be explored very much in this arc. There was quite a lot in that summary that I didn't want to go over and spoil straight away, as there is a lot of content actually in this arc, one from the exorcising of the multiple demons, and then the conclusion, which is probably the biggest part and the bit that leads us into the Illuminati arc. So what's the first thing I want to speak about? The first thing I do want to talk about is definitely Mephisto and his role in this arc. Mephisto, as we know, throughout the show has been a bit of a neutral character. And I don't say neutral in a good way. When I say neutral, I kind of mean he's not particularly known to be the villain, but can we associate him as a hero? Definitely not. Again, he's kind of the mixture between protagonist and antagonist, being productive at times and counterproductive at others. And with that being said, I think that Mephisto makes it very much clear for me, or makes the argument for me, in chapter 38. I just read out a quote from him. "However, now that the boundary line has become grey and is now going to become even greyer," or something in the vein of that. That quote, again, sticks with me. We spoke about quotes quite a lot in the casting episode, but in relation to Aono Exorcist and quotes, that quote is quite important as it explores this, well, it brings forward this idea that Mephisto even acknowledges the fact that he's within this grey area. He's not particularly the good guy, and he's not particularly the bad one. That also very much comes out within other characters within the show. But if we quickly go back to Mephisto, Mephisto's role is super important because, remember, he is very much influential. We also learn that within this chapter. Within chapter 38 and 39, we learn that Mephisto is part of this grander scheme as he, one, has the ability to control time and space, being part of the Demon Kings, and we also learn that he is a Demon King, which is very much important. What I got from that, as he's a Demon King and there are loads of other Demon Kings, is two things. Maybe he's not so important as he should be, although I sort of veer away from that point as Mephisto is very much important since he obviously runs True Cross and can control time and space, also in possession of the Maimon since the last arc, or two arcs ago even. But also it gives us this idea that he's only one part of this bigger puzzle. I think that is the point that makes more sense. He's the bigger part of this massive scheme, being Gehenna, so maybe it doesn't make it seem like he's potentially weak, but definitely gives us or points us in the direction that there is something mightier than him, and maybe Mephisto isn't the endgame of everything. I know that there's this tendency to think that Mephisto is, you know, the last thing, as his motives still are very much unclear. As, you know, sometimes, as I said before, he's counterproductive, other times he's very much productive and in favor of what goes on. That still hasn't been explored yet, so maybe Mephisto, I don't want to get into theory craft here, but maybe Mephisto isn't just the last thing we need to think about. As there are seven Demon Kings, I don't think it's going to be the case where we knock down each and every Demon King simply to, you know, collecting the nine in Attack on Titan. But I definitely think that the Demon Kings have some more importance than maybe Mephisto does, and Mephisto is only like a fragment of everything else. But if we return back to the Mephisto's mansion scene in chapter 39 and to rolling in from chapter 38, Mephisto's definitely a man of contrast, or this chapter as a whole is very much a man of contrast. It's the face of the school, the good guy doing what is arguably the bad thing, or has what is associated with a negative identity, which is being part of Gehenna. The grey area also, I don't think, is exclusive to Mephisto. In fact, it's very much within the theme, or one of the core themes of Aono Exorcist, which is identity. The identity of other characters such as Rin is obviously balanced, so being faithful to humanity in Isaiah, but possessing powers which come from Gehenna is that contradiction. Mephisto kind of is in the same vein of that. That's obviously evidenced by the fact that he runs a school within Isaiah, but is very much part of the Demon Kings. How does that balance? How is that allowed within the system? I don't know. But that is something that is definitely explored within this arc. Probably one of the most exciting introductions to one of the arcs in Aono Exorcist, actually. It definitely shows the wild side of a character like Mephisto, although we kind of knew he was quite wacky, but in this arc, it is very prominent that he is not any normal head teacher. In fact, he's something way, way, way worse that we have to consider. To quickly pick up on that point also, this was a theme that was explored very much in the OVAs as well. The OVAs of Aono Exorcist, I think there are two of them. One of them is just to do with Kuro, and it's just a bit of fun to do with food and Kuro and all of that. But then there's a second one which has to do with Shima and also Mephisto. To do with how or where do people stand in regards to not only the Isaiah Gehenna thing, but just generally when it comes to allegiance, where does everybody stand in this grand sort of scale? That is one question to Fushima, which we will get into hopefully in today's episode. But it is again a challenge for Mephisto as well, as we don't really know where everybody really pledges their allegiance to. We all just know that they go to True Cross. But obviously characters like Rin and Mephisto define that as they are kind of part of Gehenna. So how is that not particularly true for other characters? We don't know. So therefore, the OVA puts forward that question. It's quite a shame that the OVA didn't really have a payoff in the anime, because after that, Kyoto and Pure King, and then nothing came out of that in terms of a third season or the Illuminati arc or the festival arc being a part of it. So that was quite upsetting, but at least it was made and it definitely had a message, so I'm pretty happy about that. Just to wrap up on this thing about the grey area discussed in AO No Exorcist, it is definitely an interesting thing. I've said that a bunch of times now, but definitely is interesting. But why does it matter so much? Why can't we just assume that Mephisto is just a twisted character, although he kind of is? What I say to that is Mephisto has the potential to, well, has even proven even more now within this arc, that he has the ability to change the entire story or influence the direction of this entire journey, as obviously having control of time and space is one thing, but also his influence and stake within everything within the story. Almost everything links back to Mephisto, let's say that. So therefore, we really do have to consider this as if Mephisto is on the quote-unquote bad side, which is Gehenna, what does that mean for everybody else, as this is someone that we assume is very, very powerful. So I think that's something I have to keep in mind, as Mephisto can change the entire ball game. What is Mephisto's motive? We don't know, and Mephisto's motive obviously has the ability to change the entire tide of not only the True Cross Academy cram school, but everybody else within Isaiah and Gehenna. The second part of this episode is going to kind of skip through the stuff to do with the demons and exercising. I'll maybe speak a bit about that afterwards, but firstly, let's go to the Link the VA segment. It's quite upsetting that obviously we're talking about a manga here rather than an anime, so I can't really talk about voice actors within this arc. But either way, I'm going to do a Link the VA segment through all the AO No Exorcist arc episodes anyway, because I don't want to stop the series, and also I have a lot of fun with it. If you are new here to the Link the VA segment, what I do is I basically pick a voice actor from the show which we're talking about, so this time AO No Exorcist, and I just look at the roles that they play, I freak out, I have fun with it. In this edition of Link the VA, from AO No Exorcist, I think it is very much fitting for this arc to talk about Mephisto, as I just rambled about Mephisto for about 15 minutes. Mephisto's voice is quite unique throughout AO No Exorcist, and almost within any voice that I've heard within anime, as it kind of has this German twang to the Japanese. But anyway, let's get into the voice actor. The voice actor of which we'll be speaking about today is Hiroshi Kamiya, who plays a multitude of roles, and I'll quickly just talk about it right now. Every so often on the Gather Mecha podcast, we hit gold when it comes to voice actors, and they play some amazing roles, or some very notable roles that I think are like really cool from the shows that I've watched. This week is one of those weeks. We have hit gold. I'm gonna go sort of upwards in my hype scale. I'm going to go upwards in my sort of scale of voices. First role is Itetsu from Haikyuu. Itetsu from Haikyuu is a really nice voice, really sort of subtle, not particularly timid, but definitely a nice voice that I enjoy listening to. I've generally liked the side characters in Haikyuu quite a lot, and speaking of Haikyuu, I kind of stopped in the middle of second season, like episode 15, before the big spring tournament arc, which I definitely should watch, but I really did enjoy the side characters, and Itetsu is one of them, so definitely credit to him and the voice. Second role, Law from One Piece. I don't watch One Piece, but I just know Law is famous. That is about all I have to say for Law, but it's pretty cool that he wards within that, so credits to Mr. Kamiya for that. Now we're getting into the top three. These three roles are three of some of my, maybe favorites. Two of them I'd say are probably definite favorites. Third role, Levi from Attack on Titan or Shingeki no Kyojin. Levi's voice actually has a bit of similarity, I think, to Mephisto's voice. Not maybe being as wild and dynamic, but for sure sounds quite interesting and doesn't, you know, sound like straight Japanese. I think there's like a tiny, tiny bit of German twang, if I'm going to stretch it, as I do believe Attack on Titan has some German inspiration. Levi has what is described as a badass voice. It's very much, I'll kill you right now if I have to. And he exudes that personality just as much. If we take third season part two, if we take the time when he kicked the living life out of Eren, I think that's like in the first 10 episodes, he just destroys Eren with his foot. Lovely voice to go with that, just swearing all over the place in Japanese. It was an amazing episode and an amazing voice. Fourth role. The fourth role is Saiki from Saiki Kusou. This one excites me so much, so very much, that Saiki Kusou, probably one of the most blunt voices of all time, and I mean that in a good way, probably one of the most uninterested voices, is the voice that shares Mephisto, who is crazy in his voice. The contrast between the two is definitely insane. So a voice that sounds, again, German and is all over the place versus one that is very much or almost monotone gives me something to laugh about for sure. Speaking of Saiki Kusou quickly, I think I was going to speak about that in the moment segment, but Saiki Kusou getting some extra content on Netflix this year, that is probably one of the reasons why I got so excited when I saw Saiki, because I'm ready to hear that voice again. I've been wanting to hear that voice for a very long time. I think I watched Saiki Kusou last summer, so not the summer that just passed, but the summer before that, I do believe, I'm not too sure, but I laughed so hard. Okay, no, it wasn't last summer actually, but it was sometime like, I think at the end of last year, if not very early this year. I laughed so much when watching that show. It's top comedy, and I can't dispute that, and I'm ready to hear Saiki Kusou come back again with that very uninterested voice. And then the final role, this one excited me so much because I'm watching it right now, similarly to what happened in that other Link the VA segment when we looked at Futaro, I think it was, and I also hit gold and found all these other voices. This one is crazy. Okay, Araragi from the Monogatari series. That is who Mr. Kamiya plays, as well as Mephisto. Mephisto is Araragi. I kind of like Mephisto would be a villain in the Monogatari series, or at least some form of antagonist, as saying villain is kind of unclear in Monogatari, because I don't know if you can say that there are any sort of straight villains. In the Seiko the Karambi arc, you'd probably assume that Kaneki is a straight villain, but then as you get towards the Hitagi End arc and the Nadoka Medusa arc, you're kind of questioning that. The same very much applies to Mephisto and his sort of role being half and half. But anyway, if we just skip Monogatari lore aside, I'm super happy that Araragi is the voice. I feel like, okay, if I dare put this in context, I do think that Araragi's voice when he sees Hachikuji, when he goes like insanely hyper and pervy, is the very same voice channeled within Mephisto throughout basically the entirety of Aono Exorcist. That's my conspiracy, and I think it's almost a right conspiracy. I love both voices, genuinely. Araragi's voice is this mixture between goofy and what the hell, sort of. Mephisto's voice is, like, always goofy, but it's a weird goofy because we know that Mephisto isn't a joke, so that's the strange part. Anyway, that is going to do it for Link the VA. I had a great time today on Link the VA, and hopefully I'll see you next time in whatever anime we're discussing. Back to the show. The festival arc, as I said, is sandwiched between both the Kyoto Impure King arc and the Illuminati arc. And why is that? That is definitely something we have to explain, and therefore we must go to probably the number one anime betrayal ever that I've witnessed. I didn't even see it coming, to be fair. I usually check spoilers or am knowledgeful of spoilers, not because I like spoilers, but a lot of the time I'm kind of not bothered to read things, or I just want closure quickly and I just sit down and read it for the process. But with Ono Exodus, I decided no spoilers, no nothing. Luckily, the community was nice enough not to actually send me spoilers. I am relatively integrated within the Ono Exodus community, but for sure it wasn't a place where, you know, spoilers were flying left, right and center, which is really happy and really thankful for that. So I was reading this, I think I was reading this in bed actually, because I like to read manga in bed sometimes. It's a nice way to like get to sleep if you put your phone on low brightness and all. Anyway, I was doing that, and then the biggest betrayal happened, and that is Shima's betrayal. Shima's betrayal is probably the thing that makes this arc the arc it is, as it's almost this last minute switcheroony from what was looking like a happy festival between, you know, Rin and Yukio and Shimi. It was looking positive, everything was looking fresh and happy, and the disruption comes in that is, Shima is a part of the Illuminati. That hurts a lot, and I think we can very much link that to this idea of where do characters stand. Shima, from what we know, doesn't particularly stand where we think he does. We can also say the same for Gamaki later in the Illuminati arc, not in the way that you're thinking, but you should have already watched it if you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, it gets different from there. But if we're talking on the raw or the core idea of good and bad, Shima isn't really on the good side, or the side that we thought was good, being an XY, training to be an exorcist and blah blah blah. In fact, he has allegiances elsewhere. That is also teased in the OVA, where we see that Shima has the ability to be quite a good spy for a variety of reasons. I've watched the OVA quite a long time ago, so I don't really remember the exact details. But it went along the lines of he's a good spy, he's not very suspectable, as I think he's like quite dopey, so people don't suspect him so much. And Mephisto basically came up with a list of reasons as to why he would be almost the perfect spy or someone to collect intelligence. And that very thing came true. Again, credit to the OVA for making that suspicion clear. Although, was it the smartest move to put that in? I don't know, because suspicion is something that you obviously want to creep up on you. It didn't really creep up on me in that situation because they kind of teased it sort of as a part of him being not particularly as he seems to be. But anyway, back to Shima. Shima's allegiance isn't one that's clear-cut, similar to the grey area which we were speaking about in the bit about Mephisto. The grey area is a massive theme. In fact, it's probably the central theme within Ono Exodus. It's one, the grey area between Gehenna and Isaiah, and also the grey area between good and bad, or loyal and disloyal. The emotional impact, one, is a big thing, so it just hits you straight away that someone that said he was, you know, he was just part of the group, he was friends with other people, he was one of us, and then he turns. That definitely has a big impact on, or had a big impact on me, and maybe on other audience members as well. I'll quickly say like a quote or two from Shima in that moment, and I'll quickly talk about why that feels like such a big deal. He goes on and says, "Saying that I'm a quote-unquote spy is an exaggeration. My job is only to watch the cram school exorcist students. It's the first time that I've been given an order that actually looks like one." That makes me so angry, but kind of excited that this character definitely is entrenched within this system of, you know, not particularly elitism, but kind of elitism. He thinks he's above the students, as, you know, he effectively is a student. He was among their age, but kind of just looks down on them as if nothing happened. Yet before, you know, he was praising Bon and everything like that. So a bit hypocritical, but quite funny, in fact, that someone just thinks that they're instantaneously better than everyone else. He also makes it seem as if it's no big deal that he was doing any of this. He's kind of just like, the boss is here, let's go, good work, thank you, goodbye, see you losers elsewhere. That was kind of funny. I don't know whether I should be finding this, I don't know whether I should be finding this funny or upsetting, but in fact, I find it a combination of the two. Because he makes it seem so casual. He makes it seem as if nothing happened, or it was, you know, it had to go this way, see you guys. I'm kind of not part of you anymore. that hurt, but it also hurt for the good as well. Well, it was definitely quite entertaining. It was a switch that I'm happy happened, as the way AONOXIS was going, and I don't really miss as a criticism, but the way it was going, it felt almost too happy, or at least the team unit was almost too unified. AONOXIS first season, or at least the arcs in the first season, definitely challenged the relationship, so, and even the Kyoto Imperial King arc as we spoke about. So arc 1 and arc 2 are very much about how the team are going to work together, the nature of the team, why some people don't like others on the team, the hardships within the team, and then success being closing Gehina's gate temporarily. The second season, again, challenges those relationships. So Kamaki and Shimi, Rin and Bon, Rin and Yukio, Yukio basically and himself and everything else. There's a lot of challenge which goes into that. But then after that, I feel like everyone is sort of united or on the same page. But apparently that's not true with the festival arc. The pages are very much different. The festival arc, in fact, feels too good to be true for a time when Shimi is pushing for this sort of relationship, or not really a relationship, but Rin kind of is showing signs that he likes Shimi, which I'm happy that happened. I ship it, you know. I like to ship Rin and Shimi. But then that is very much contrasted with the other side of relationships being the team. And that collective unit is broken by someone basically dipping and saying, I don't really care about everything that we did because I wasn't really a part of it in the first place. It was in fact all a mission to just look over you guys. That is the bit I think hurts the most, and that's why it is quite impactful. This stigma or elitism, if you want to call it, I don't know really which one I can allocate it to, but the stigma or elitist value is one that is set up here very much for the Illuminati arc. Obviously, the transition between the festival arc and the Illuminati arc is very smooth, as the kidnapping of Kamaki, which is Shima's quote-unquote big betrayal, is the main theme of the Illuminati arc. I'm really happy that there is a nice smooth transition between the two. This is probably the most smooth transition from the arcs we've spoken about. As I said, the Kyoto Saga arc, I do think is quite disconnected from most of the show, or the anime slash manga at least, from my understanding. The festival arc and the Illuminati arc have a very smooth transition between the two. In fact, you could call them all one arc. But as I was saying before, this stigma of others, or this at least that elitism at least, is central in the Illuminati arc, as there's a whole character based off it. And Shima obviously brings that into the limelight, which I think is quite smart to bring in, because why not introduce a concept early and develop it within a character being almost the embodiment of that? Obviously, I'm not going to spoil the Illuminati arc right now and start talking about it, although it would be a great show to do so. But as I was saying, the connection between the two is quite important. AONOXIS has struggled in the past to create connections kind of between its arcs. And that transition between the festival arc and the Illuminati arc blows that criticism out of the water. Before we get to closing thoughts, let's talk about what I've been watching and reading recently. This is the In The Moment segment for this week. This week has been quite a good week when it comes to anime and comics, or okay, let me leave out comics. I think more anime and manga for this week has been quite a focus for me. The first one, which I'm really excited to say, is that I have completed the entirety of Mob Psycho 100 and Mob Psycho 102 when it comes to the anime. I will consider reading the manga, or whether it's, I think it's a web novel, whatever it is, I will most likely read that because I cannot wait. Honestly, I'm very much blown away by Mob Psycho 102, and it has now, if you follow me on Twitter, which you should, I'm kind of alluding to it being my favorite anime of the year. It has done so much, both visually when it comes to Sakuga, and also just narrative-wise and structurally. It does everything that I would expect, while still keeping it within its own formula. I feel like OPM 2 didn't particularly do that. It tried to work outside of its formula, and obviously when it came to execution, it failed quite a bit, Mob Psycho 102 does the complete opposite. It plays it relatively safe while still being very much daring when it comes to, you know, how the story progresses when we get to the World Domination arc and the Mogami arc. I love that show very much. That show is something that I'm going to keep with me for a very long time. Even the Shimazaki fight was just amazing to watch. Shimazaki, although still being a supporting role, felt so relevant and active within the show. It also proves, okay, I'm not going to do a whole analysis of Mob Psycho 102 today, but the show proves, or definitely sets the tone when it comes to one story's, in contrast to, you know, one's other story, One Punch Man, how to introduce multiple characters without overshadowing or almost sidelining the main character, in this case Shigeo. It is done so well to the extent where so many characters are introduced within Mob 2, but Shigeo still remains the focus, and that is why I think that Mob 2 is the better story made by One. Not to sort of discredit One Punch Man completely, because I still do like it, and I don't want to start a whole, you know, XY comparison here, but that is one thing that I picked up on this week. Second thing this week, which is kind of news, sort of, I might make this a bit of a more anime news segment. Saiki Kuzo. This isn't particularly recent, I'm speaking like a week ahead. New Saiki Kuzo is here, and I'm so excited for it. New Saiki Kuzo should be around in about 2 months. I am desperate to see this, and it's on Netflix as well. Hopefully they maintain the tone of the show, as the tone of the show at the moment is amazing. The way Saiki Kuzo 2 ended was great, and I hope that they pick up on that ending, the quote-unquote ending or finale of Saiki Kuzo. Hopefully they do something to change that in a good way. So hopefully, as I've said hopefully a million times, Netflix picks up on that and makes it something amazing to watch. We even spoke about Saiki Kuzo over in the Link the VA segment. You can tell my passion for this show. Ever since watching it, I haven't stopped thinking about it. I laugh at it every time. The jokes are amazing. The music is great. The structure is great. It's a great show, and I highly recommend watching it in preparation for December 2019. And final bit before I quickly do a bit of housekeeping, kind of. I finished a manga. Okay, if you take your mind back to a few episodes, I honestly can't tell you what episode it was. I spoke about an anime called Masamune's Revenge. And I gave a bit of a hot take on, okay, not a hot take, because I don't think I have many hot takes. I gave a bit of a take on it, basically saying that, it's not that great. And I read the manga, and I feel a bit better. Do I feel basically the same? Yes. But on a molecular level, do I feel slightly better? Yes. Masamune's Revenge is not one that you see every day. It's a revenge story about a guy, totally something you don't see every day. But its manga had some parts that really annoyed me. It felt like they were putting things in for the sake of putting them in, and then sometimes even forgetting about them. All I'll say is Hives. If you've read that manga, you know what I'm talking about when I say Hives. That meant nothing to the rest of the show besides some random rubbish. But anyway, that has been Masamune's Revenge. I had fun, at least. I read it very quickly, actually. I read it, I think it was in 2 nights or something like that. I read about like 20, 30 chapters almost back to back. It was juicy, though. There was a lot of drama. If you're looking for drama, classic teen stupid drama, read Masamune's Revenge, as it will give you plenty of it and plenty of plot twists to sink your teeth into. That is basically the In the Moment segment. Let's quickly do a bit of housekeeping. Episodes coming up. The action arc is coming soon, so my second Evangelion episode will be coming in some time. And also, the second part of the Tokyo Ghoul rant is coming. Hopefully it won't be as bad as it was in episode 2, both in terms of audio quality and anger. Hopefully I'm slightly softer on part 2. I don't know if I will. I can't guarantee it, but I will try my best. And then one more thing, I'm not going to give away the entirety of everything I'm going to speak about on the show. But another one that is coming is the Decade Review. This is something I've been trying to plan for almost before the podcast existed. Reviewing this decade of anime in a very summarized fashion, I'm going to try my best to put that out. hopefully sometime in December. The year review maybe will become a thing, but the decade review, I'm going to try my best to get that out. Anyway, that is going to do it for the Indie Moment segment for this week. And as you know, we do sell out when we finish the Indie Moment segment. As always, follow me on Twitter. That is at GETINTHEMECHA, Get in the Mecha. Also, check out the blog. That is getinthemecha.home.blog. All the show notes and all the episodes are there as of now on the blog. So you can listen to the show on the site. You can read all the show notes. I write a decent amount, like over a page of show notes usually, of things that happen in the episode, all the relevant links and the music from the episode. And finally, if you love the show, review it, because I get to know how much you are enjoying it and I can improve it even more. And finally, subscribe if you just want to get these as soon as they come out and you want to be a lovely early bird and hear my voice. Anyway, that is going to do it for this week's In The Moment segment. Back to the show. So let's summarize how I feel about the festival arc. The festival arc definitely is in an interesting position. I've said interesting too many times today, sorry. We're in a sort of weird position, mostly because we're sandwiched between two arcs of decent size, the Kyoto Imperial King arc and the Illuminati arc. However, with all of that being said, the transition between festival and Illuminati is amazingly smooth. Definitely bringing back the smoothness of the show between the arcs. It doesn't feel disjointed between the two, which I'm very much in favor for. Also, the festival arc brings forward some concepts that we are going to be introduced to later in the show at the very end, and also sets up for the long term being this massive thing known as the gray area. The gray area being this concept, this mix between who is good and bad. So it's between the binary opposites. Some people aren't particularly going to be on the complete good or complete bad side. Similarly to D&D, you have neutral good, chaotic evil, chaotic good, lawful good, all of that. It's very much the same thing in AO No Exorcist, and some characters will not always be dead center. Shima obviously being an example of not being dead center, Mephisto, Reen, that is a theme that is strung very much through completely. But as a whole, I think we can even apply it to Yukio and his role within the Kyoto Impure King arc in regards to the Gehenna Isaiah scale. So that grey area is very much teased out, as well as this more short-term idea of elitism, or at least the stigma towards others that Shima shares and will be explored within the Illuminati arc. So do I enjoy this arc? Yes. Although you can probably tell that the reason why I didn't speak about the middle of it, so, you know, exercising all those demons, is although there is some value to it when it comes to the relationships in the show, it did get a tiny bit tedious, and that is probably my only criticism in regards to the festival arc. There is that, it's not a disjoint, because the disjoint, I would say, belongs further back, so the Kyoto Impure King moving into festival. That transition between Mephisto's mansion, which I very much liked. I think the Mephisto's mansion scene or chapters were full of context and also gave us a good insight into, you know, Reen, Amaimon, and none other than Mephisto, basically the star of this episode alongside Shima. But also transitioning from that to exercising demons almost every chapter felt kind of boring to me. That again is my only criticism. I don't want to dwell on it too much because I don't want to take away the praise I give this arc, considering it is effectively a prelude and it does tease out this whole idea of the barrier as well. But also, it did feel a bit lengthy. I think it did stretch a tiny bit. But just to like roll over that, it is compensated for when it comes to the betrayal of Shima and the Mephisto's mansion scene. Those two things are working really well to sort of end the arc and begin the arc really strongly. Also, you can argue that those episodes in between, being the exorcism episodes, chapters, sorry, I'm getting mixed up between manga and anime. the chapters are really good for building up the relationships and notion of the team by obviously doing team activities. So doing those team activities make the team seem united, and therefore Shima disrupts that order, making his betrayal seem almost more impactful as he was a part of that very team. He destroyed what he was effectively part of, which really hurts. So the Festival arc is quite a good arc. I think it's almost symbolic of Aenoexis getting back on track. I would definitely recommend it. Don't skip it. Don't skip arcs in general. I wouldn't recommend it. But don't skip this one. Don't sleep on this one, as there are two amazing gems that this arc holds. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Get in the Mecha podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed it. I had quite a fun time with it. I think maybe I waffled slightly a bit or went on a bit of a tangent when it came to Shima, but that guy deserves it because he made that arc really enjoyable by the end, to be fair. That's basically going to do it for this week. I've planned out some episodes coming up, so next episode I should be speaking about, if I'm not wrong, the Return to Shiganshina arc of Attack on Titan. I've been speaking about Attack on Titan a lot on the podcast recently. This one is going to be a flat out conclusive Return to Shiganshina review. Nothing else. Not an OP, not a specific moment. Just the Return to Shiganshina and nothing else. And then we can work backwards through the arcs of Attack on Titan. After that, I don't really remember what's next, but definitely Evangelion episode coming soon, Tokyo Ghoul episode coming soon, Attack on Titan episode coming next week. We're getting to episode 20, which is really good, and I'm really excited. The show is getting somewhere. Hopefully you guys are enjoying it. Obviously leave a review if you are enjoying it. And yeah, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you for listening, and I will hopefully see you in the next one. Goodbye. The music in this production goes as follows: Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming, Difference by Chasers Gaming, Chipscape by Chasers Gaming, Mandatory Overtime by Joth, Anomaly by Eric Medeas under soundimage.org, and Autumn of Life by Eric Medeas under soundimage.org.